welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 6th of April 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, everybody else's problems with the virus are actually our gain, because once again, I have my co-host with me here today, Max Musson. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing? Not stir crazy yet, I take it?
No, I'm finding lots of things to occupy my time, and it's not a situation I would actually ideally like to be in, because I think that to a certain extent we're all in a state of suspended animation, and I would far rather be living a life rather than just existing and waiting for the virus to pass. But you know, we are in the situation that we're in, and we just have to make the best of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of frayed tempers and a lot of people sort of getting wound up because they can't really get out, especially people that haven't got gardens that are stuck in their flats. I mean, they were talking today that if people continue to go out, they're going to stop people going to the parks, which will be a nightmare for people that are cooped up in a flat for 12 weeks or however long it's going to go on for. Now, I have talked quite a lot about the coronavirus last week, so I'm not really going to talk about that much today, although I will hand it over to you to get your views on it and what's happening in Britain. I just wanted to answer a couple of conspiracy theories, basically, just here at the beginning, with reference to Britain. A lot of people have been saying the numbers of the dead that we're getting, they're mixed up with people that they may have died with coronavirus, but they may not have died of coronavirus. Now, that may be what's happening in Italy, but over here in Britain, the numbers of dead that we're being given each day actually come from the hospitals, and it's only the people that have died on the ventilators. So it's only people that have actually died on the ventilators are being given to us. People that have died in nursing homes are not included in these figures. And then people might say, well, how do we know that they had the coronavirus? Because we've got problems with the tests. Yes, we have got problems with the tests. We've got a lot of false positives, false negatives. We don't know if the test is actually testing for the correct virus, because apparently it was never purified at first. But these people that are dying on the ventilators that have been taken into the hospitals, they will have been x-rayed. And the x-ray is really the only known way to confirm that someone has this COVID-19. Because by the time they're at the stage that they need oxygen and they need ventilating, you can x-ray them and you can see what's called the ground glass effect. And they've got all these white blotches over their lungs, which is necrotic tissue, basically. So we do know that the dead that are coming out of the hospitals, these figures we're getting, they are people that have died of coronavirus. And that is a test that does show that we have this coronavirus. And the third thing that I wanted to talk about is hospitals. A lot of people have been saying, oh, the hospitals are all empty. There's lots of people been walking around them and there's nobody there. And we've actually had somebody who's just been jailed for 3 months for walking around the hospital when, of course, he's supposed to be at home under the house arrest, under the quarantine. But you wouldn't expect to see lots of people in the hospitals, because all the routine surgery, all the routine operations, that has all been stopped. People have been told not to go to the hospitals. They're told to ring a phone number if you want to speak to a doctor. If you were ill, the last place you would want to go is to a hospital, because you might catch coronavirus. So that's why the hospitals are empty. Also, when they say a hospital is up to its capacity with COVID-19 patients, it doesn't mean that the hospital is filled right up to the brim. It means that the small area that they have, which is intensive care and critical care, which may only be 10% of the hospital, it means that that part is full up. Because once they've run out of ventilators, and there's a limited number of ventilators in each hospital, once they have run out of ventilators, there is no point in any more COVID patients going to that hospital. 90% of the space could still be there, but there's no point bringing COVID-19 patients there, because they're all going to need a ventilator. This is why they've built this 4,000 capacity intensive care unit, basically, in the Excel Centre in London. So the people that are saying this is all a hoax, the hospitals are empty, it's completely logical that some of these hospitals would appear to be empty. Plus, it's also not evenly spread around the country. Most of it is in London. So if you've got areas of the country that really haven't got that much of a problem with it yet, if you go to their hospitals, of course they're going to be empty. So there's two main reasons there why these hospitals are empty. Because if they're full up, it just means the intensive care unit is full up. And also because you've got varying rates of the disease. So I hope that answers, you know, some of these conspiracy theories. But anyway, Max, what are your thoughts on the corona situation in Britain at the moment?
Well, the corona situation seems to be polarizing the opinion amongst government advisors. And what we have are those government advisors who perceive that the lockdown, the current lockdown situation, is vital to us overcoming the disease, and who are talking about the prospect that the lockdown may need to be extended beyond this initial 3 week period to encompass perhaps the next 6 months, or perhaps even some people have been talking about 18 months. And and then there are the other group who are saying the lockdown is causing a tremendous amount of damage to the economy. And this schism between the two groups has tended to cause people to, particularly on the left, to turn around and say, well, you know, lives come before profits. And what they're thinking there is that those that are talking about the damage being done to the economy are only thinking of the interests of people who are perhaps entrepreneurs or business people, and so therefore that are thinking in terms of the traditional Labour Tory cleft within our society between people who are socialistically minded and people who are capitalistically minded. But it isn't really that. You see, the point is that the amount of additional spending that's been announced by Rishi Sunak is very, very considerable indeed, and it represents a marked step away from what have traditionally been conservative ideology and conservative policies. So rather than opting on the side of financial prudence, what's happened is that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson have decided to spend the money that's necessary to get to grips with this disease. But the amounts that are being spent, and the amounts that are being spent in order to keep large sections of our economy idle at home, and so in lockdown so that they don't spread the disease, are likely to cause quite a considerable increase in government spending, and most of the additional money to be spent is going to be money that's going to be borrowed, and that's going to mean that the national debt is going to increase quite significantly. And if the period of lockdown is maintained for too long, then we'll end up in a situation where we will save lives as a result of the lockdown. But when people emerge from lockdown, what they'll find is that the economy that previously sustained them will no longer be functioning properly, that there will be widespread unemployment, and that there probably will be raging inflation, and we probably will have a nationwide recession. In fact, not just a nationwide recession, because most countries have been following this kind of lockdown policy. There could well be a world recession that might last for, you know, perhaps as long as 10 years or more. And so the balancing act that Boris Johnson needs to take is between taking the very cautious steps of maintaining lockdown in order to maximize the survival rate of people who are elderly and in the high-risk groups, whilst at the same time not maintaining the lockdown so long that the economy is damaged to such an extent that once the virus has run its course, that young people find that they live for the next 10 years in a state of poverty as a result of it. And so it is a very real dilemma for the government. And so that's the discussion that's taking place at the moment. And it's an interesting discussion. I have always advocated there should be a twin track policy. And I've sort of mentioned this in our previous broadcasts. I've mentioned it in the articles that I've published on Western Spring website. And as far as this twin track policy is concerned, I think that, rather than us follow the sort of crudely outlined herd immunity kind of, policy that was spoken about, that, we should take steps to look after the people who are the most vulnerable in our society. And the government should give people a choice, or should designate people basically into one of two categories. Either they will be people who are in the high risk groups, in which case they should be kept in a voluntary isolation where they can remain separate and apart from anybody who may be carrying the disease, and then social services should be expanded to ensure that those people are supplied with the food and the supplies, etc., that they're needed in order to sustain life until the virus has run its course. And the rest of the population, the people who are younger, who have got a very low risk of mortality as far as the disease is concerned, for whom the disease is probably no more dangerous than the flu, they can carry on living their lives as normal, and can continue to go to the pub, can continue to attend live performances in stages and things, can continue to visit relatives, etc. And amongst the group of the population who are to be protected, who are in the high-risk groups, if there are any people who qualify as a member of one of those high-risk groups, if they choose not to go into lockdown and they choose to carry on living their life as normal, then they should be allowed to do that. The point being here that as far as the elderly are concerned, there are going to be quite a lot of elderly people who may perhaps only have 18 months of life left, irrespective of the virus. They may have diseases they don't even know about. They may have diseases they do know about, but they may have diseases that are associated with old age, and they may only have 18 months left. Now, if the lockdown period lasts for 18 months, they could spend the last 18 months of their life in a kind of isolation where they lose track of contact with their children and their grandchildren, and where they eventually succumb to perhaps the virus, go off to hospital, and because of the fear of cross-infection, they may end up dying in a hospital ward surrounded by strangers, having not seen anybody, any member of their family or any of their loved ones for 18 months. And that would be a very, very sad thing to do. And I think that anybody who is in that high risk category who feels that they would far rather live out the last 18 months of their life with all the joy that can come from contact with the younger members of their family, and they're prepared to take the risk of the virus, just accept that risk and just live with it, those people should be allowed to do that. But I think that certainly keeping the whole population, as we have at the moment, in lockdown for too long is going to be, from an economic perspective, quite a dangerous thing for the government to do.
Well, I think they will probably end up doing something like that. I mean, what they're talking about now is once they manage to get a test for antibodies, and they can test people and they can say, right, well, this tells us that you've had the disease, you're not likely to be able to get it again, you can now have this certificate which says that you can now go back to work. So that's what they're talking about doing now. But of course, they haven't actually got a test for these antibodies. I suspect that if you were to tell old people that, you know, they had the choice of going into quarantine or just staying seeing their families, I suspect the majority of them would say, well, we would rather not worry about it and just go and see our families, and if we get ill, we get ill. I mean, that seems to be the attitude of most elderly people. But of course, what you're saying there about this schism there between the government, what you would normally expect the opposition, you would expect the Labour Party to be the ones who were saying, well, we need to put human life first and not worry about the economy. And you would expect the Conservatives to be saying, well, no, we've got to be careful about the economy. But what we've actually got is we've got the Conservatives saying, well, we need to be more concerned about saving human life than the economy. And now we've got a new leader of the Labour Party, we've got Keir Starmer, and he's going on at the government saying that this lockdown needs to go on for longer. It needs to go on for much longer, and it needs to be more stringent. So we can't look to Keir Starmer to actually provide this opposition in the hopes that we would somehow get a balance there, which is rather unfortunate. The election of Keir Starmer has been quite interesting, actually. He gave his speech yesterday, and the central point of it was that he would judge whether or not his leadership of the Labour Party has been a success by how many Jews joined the Labour Party. I mean, he certainly knows who he needs to impress in order to get on in politics, I think. What do you make of Keir Starmer? And can you see any other way out of this, Max? I mean, if they can find this test for the antibodies, then they're saying that they'll give people certificates and they can then go back to work. So they are obviously thinking about this to some extent, I think.
Well, just sticking on the coronavirus subject, I think that I think the economic pressure on the government to ease the lockdown will become irresistible, and they will grasp whatever opportunities come along in order to be able to do that. And I think that if the tests to determine whether people have had the coronavirus become available in large enough numbers, or even if the tests to determine whether somebody is currently suffering from coronavirus, if they become available, that the test equipment becomes available in sufficient quantities in order for there to be widespread testing, then I think that sort of testing ought to be something that's done and being is made a priority. And so that would provide the government then with the means to be able to start migrating the economy out of lockdown and back to some semblance of normality. The longer it takes, and at the moment there doesn't seem to be a ready supply of test kits available, but the longer it takes, my fear is that the greater the amount of damage that will be caused to the economy. It would be a great irony if we emerge from lockdown only to find that the country is then in a state of penury as a result of the debts that we've taken on, and that penury then causes cutbacks in government expenditure that then causes as many people to die of other diseases because of lack of medical care than might have died of coronavirus had we not gone into lockdown. You know, those sort of things need to be weighed up. As far as Keir Starmer is concerned, I think that he has been the obvious person that was likely to be chosen simply by virtue of the fact that the lady who was Jeremy Corbyn's preferred successor.
I remembered it earlier and it's gone completely out of my mind now. She's so inconsequential, but I was really hoping she was going to win because that would have been very funny.
I think from her point of view, she was, by virtue of the fact that she was regarded as being Jeremy Corbyn's rightful successor, I think that basically meant that she had a fairly sort of poison situation by virtue of the fact that the very reason that the Labour leadership election was held was as a result of Jeremy Corbyn being eventually discredited. And the discrediting of Jeremy Corbyn was largely as a result of this four-year smear campaign that was waged against him by the media and by organised Jewry in this country, who didn't want him to be the Labour leader because he isn't a Zionist. And so they've eventually got their way, and the smear campaign was so effective that Labour lost the general election by a country mile, which then provided the pretext for Jeremy Corbyn to be removed from office. So Jeremy Corbyn's removed from office, and Keir Starmer is the one that's come forward who appears to have the right kind of out of the people that were contesting the election. He was the one that had the most experience. Plus, also he was the one who made a big deal out of the fact that he has a Jewish wife and that he's raising his children as Jews. And so that then made him the favoured candidate as far as organised Jewry is concerned. And so therefore he hasn't suffered the same sort of smears that Jeremy Corbyn suffered, and that to a certain extent spilled over onto his named successor, whatever her name is. And it's interesting, though, that the this issue of his wife's Jewishness didn't seem to be publicized nationally during the election campaign. It was just publicized within the Jewish press. But now that he is elected leader, you know, he made a big thing about it in the speech and how he was going to make his priority ridding the Labour Party of the poison of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, the well-being of Jews is his central point. Yeah, I wasn't aware that he actually had a Jewish wife. You know, that's news to me, but it doesn't surprise me. The lady that was in second place, I think, was Rebecca Long Bailey. That was
name
of the Jeremy Corbyn acolyte. Well, as I said, I did actually find a piece of news that wasn't to do with Corona this week, and it's actually an article that was published in the Metro, and I thought it really shows how our enemies, they only have dishonest arguments against us. They can only either use straw man arguments or dishonest arguments. And this is a really good example of a dishonest argument that's been put out there to discredit what nationalists say and really what just the general white British public are saying. The title of this article is "The Majority of Sexual Offenders Are White Men. There is no Muslim problem with sexual grooming." I mean, that is a very provocative title when a couple of years back we saw that it could have been up to 1 million white girls that were actually the victims of grooming. And of course, it's by a non-white lady by the name of Fahima Bakar. And she's actually been doing a whole series on this, apparently. She says, "Our series, The State of Racism, has been running over the past 6 weeks to illuminate just how prevalent racism is in the UK. We've also been highlighting the unique dilemmas faced by certain groups, from black mums to South Asian Muslims. But every time I have written about Muslims, I have received one recurring comment on my Facebook, Twitter, emails, and in the article comments. What about the grooming gangs? Why is this brought up every time I mention an obstacle faced by Muslims?" Well, is it because of the whitewash, obviously, because they're covering this up and the mainstream press won't talk about it. She says, "Do the crimes of a few speak for all Muslims? Obviously not. But it seems this constant bleating about Muslim grooming gangs is specifically being used to shut down important discussions about Islamophobia." And I would suggest that it's actually the other way around. As soon as anybody starts talking about Muslim grooming gangs, they get accused of Islamophobia. And then she comes out with the dishonesty. She says, "And while it's difficult to measure the ethnicity of sexual offenders, there is clear evidence in many reports that the majority have been white men, not Asian Muslims. Almost 85% of offenders found guilty of sexual activity with a minor in England and Wales in 2011 were white, while 4% were Asian." And of course, the main dishonesty in this is she's saying, look, 85% of these sexual crimes are carried out by white men, but white men make up 85% of the population. So it's just the normal amount that you would expect to see. Normally you would expect to see 85% of any crime being carried out by white men, because white men are 85% of the population. The second bit of dishonesty in this is that these are figures from 2011. This is 3 years before the Rotherham scandal broke. This is at the time when we know the police were not investigating any sexually related crimes that were allegedly carried out by non-whites in the interests of community cohesion. So she's presenting this as if this is just happening now, and these are the figures, and only 4% were Asian. And in actual fact, we know from the Quilliam report that 85% of all the grooming gang members were actually Muslim. 85% of them were Asian, which is about 20 times as many as it should be if they just make up 4% of the population, yet they make up 85% of the grooming gangs. So she's just being dishonest here. And this is her trying to discredit people that are obviously saying, look, it's an important issue to talk about. These rape gangs are an important issue. And she's made this article. It's in a mainstream press. It's in the Metro. And it's basically putting across dishonest figures. It's saying that it shouldn't be 85% of offenders shouldn't be white when they should be. And it's figures from 2011. It's just incredible. What do you make of this barefaced cheek here from this non-white journalist, Max?
Well, there is a clear difference in the two things. The first is that as far as white paedophilia is concerned, it is carried out usually by an individual or a small group of individuals who hide their identity because they are effectively ashamed of what they do the grooming and the abuse that they carry out is very often against children that they know, and sometimes they are relatives in the family carrying out the grooming. And in some of those cases, the grooming and the sexual abuse of those children isn't violent sexual abuse. It is simply that the male member of the family who's carrying out the abuse is using his influence as an older relative in order to make the victim subservient to him and to bend to his wishes. And so that is, as I say, one of these forms of paedophilia. The other one, which is the paedophilia committed by the Asian grooming gangs, is where the grooming is carried out by men who are strangers. And that the strangers gain their hold over their victims, not by virtue of the fact that they are an older influential member of the family, but they gain their hold by luring the victims into drink and drugs, so that they make them addicted to drugs, and the drink and drugs are then used to blackmail the youngsters. The young female victims are then passed around between very large groups of men who know each other and who and so it's not something that's done secretly. It's something that tends to happen quite openly amongst very large groups of Muslim men who seem to know each other and to organize as a gang in order to procure girls and in order to abuse them, and they use violence often as well in order to impose their will on the young people. And so not only are the girls concerned, the victims, not only are they made drunk and given drugs, but they are then beaten and threatened, and their families are threatened in order to subdue them and to make them conform and cooperate to the wishes of the paedophile. So the way in which the abuse takes place is entirely different in those two groups, by and large. And the other aspect of it, of course, is that firstly, the Muslim gangs take care not to target their own the young ladies of their own community. They target the young ladies and girls of majority ethnic community, and so therefore there is a racial element to it. They believe that it would be sinful for them to conduct themselves in the way that they do with females of their own ethnic community, but it's they seem to feel that it's okay for them to do it to females of the ethnic majority. And then the other aspect of this is that is the police cover up, where the police are always interested when there is evidence of paedophilia and child sexual abuse within the white community, and they actively hunt down the people concerned and bring them to justice. As far as the Asian grooming gangs are concerned, the police have shown themselves to be afraid of doing that for fear of being called racist, and they have over a considerable period of time, running into now decades, shown a tendency to turn a blind eye and to allow the abuse to take place without any real attempts to stamp it out, and to such an extent that one suspects that not only were they looking the other way, but they perhaps were in cahoots with the people who were actually committing the abuse. And it's shameful that there have been, to my knowledge, no senior police officers in the areas where this abuse has been shown to have taken place over a prolonged period of time. There have been no senior police officers who have been brought to justice for collusion with the grooming gangs that operated in their areas.
It's actually a false equivalency that she's drawing here between these grooming gangs and the child sexual abuse with the white communities. And it's also a damning indictment of the police that in 2011, only 4% of child sexual abuse crimes were found to be down to the Muslim community. Because as we know, 85% of the grooming gangs were non-white. Grooming gangs is just not something that exists in white culture. It only exists in the Muslim culture, whether they're Asians, whether they're blacks, whether they're Arabs. It's a different group that carries it out all over Europe. You've got the Somalians carrying it out in Finland. You've got Moroccans carrying it out in Holland. And it all depends on the largest ethnic group of Muslims that's in the country is the majority involved in these grooming gangs. But she says to say it's an intrinsically Muslim problem is a lazy, transparent tactic, and the inaccuracies behind these claims need to be dismantled in order to move the conversation on. Okay, then, so where are your statistics to show that there are any white grooming gangs? She doesn't have any. She says grooming gangs are only depicted to be an Asian or Muslim problem because of a few high-profile cases and the media's penchant to overreport certain types of stories. But the media doesn't overreport it. The media has banning orders put on it so that it can't report on it. And you will only find the stories about it in the local news reports. And you won't find any of any white grooming gangs. And I dare say they're desperate to actually find any. She says the reasons people seem to be so consistently hung up on this issue is twofold. First, because it reinforces already held racist stereotypes of Muslim men as threatening and regressive. Well, I wasn't aware of any stereotypes of Muslim men as being threatening and regressive. I wasn't aware of stereotypes of them being grooming gangs. I mean, this was news reports that came out that told us this. And secondly, because the most oft-cited cases of sexual grooming involve white working class girls and women. So she's saying that this has been covered up because it was white women, because the victims were white women. Well, we agree with that. In the sexual exploitation cases of Rochdale and Rotherham in Yorkshire, there was extraordinary neglect against the mostly white victims aged 12 to 16. How they were treated was largely due to classism and misogyny. No, they were ignored because they were white and the criminals that were doing this to them were brown. The girls were from working class backgrounds, which is often thought to signify laziness or fecklessness, and they suffered misogyny, thought to be available, a kind of oppression assigned to anyone who looks like a girl or woman and wears anything suggestive. But the reports that have come out have said that the reason why this wasn't investigated is because of the interests of community cohesion. There haven't been any reports that said this wasn't investigated because the police hate women, regardless of what race they are. There's been no reports that say that. She says, consider this, had the victims also been of Asian and or Muslim descent, would the uproar be the same? There are actually Muslim victims of sexual exploitation, but they are often missed because of the focus on white victims. Well, we did actually hear of some Muslim victims of this, and the Muslim perpetrator was actually told by the judge that what he had done was far worse than if he had done it to white victims. And he actually increased the prison sentence because the Muslim had been abusing other Muslims. And of course, we've also got female genital mutilation that goes on in the Muslim community. And we have a massive concentration on this, even though there aren't that many that they've actually caught. But they have a real highlighting of this actual crime. So it's not like they're ignoring this. She says, we can also ask if the perpetrators were also white, would their race be mentioned? Well, there aren't any. There aren't any white grooming gangs. We've never heard of any white grooming gangs. In this case, one of the most reported aspects was the commonality of the gangs in terms of their ethnic and religious background. The fact that whiteness so often goes unchecked and becomes an invisible default is one of the reasons we launched the State of Racism. So just being a white man now is whiteness, and apparently we're going unchecked. We need to be checked. It's our fault, not the Muslims' fault, for actually doing this grooming and raping. She says, granted, sexual abuse should always be taken seriously, but there is only one thing in common with sexual predators, the crimes they've committed. But their background is often mentioned because there's an appetite to be fed about how backwards Muslims are. Well, no, we need to know what these people have in common. It's like when you hear about celebrities that carry out these crimes, celebrities like Jimmy Savile, and the crimes that you pointed out earlier, Max, the crimes that happen within the family. So but up until there were these grooming gangs, they used to say you're most likely to be abused by a member of your own family. They didn't say, well, that was being familyist, that was being prejudiced against people of the family. You shouldn't have mentioned that the rapist was the girl's stepfather because that's against stepfathers. No, they told people that so that people were aware of this. So we've got this double standard here. And then she says, we see the same thing happen in cases of terrorism where attacks by Muslims receive 357% more press attention than when white people do it. Well, could that possibly be because Muslims are responsible for 357 times more terrorism than white people? I mean, white people are responsible for about 1% of the terrorism worldwide. And that comes from figures from Tony Blair's foundation a couple of years ago that looked into who was responsible for all the terrorism. So Muslims are responsible for a lot more terrorism. That's why they get more press attention. And she finishes, she says, these grooming gang cases are complex and there are racial elements to it. The perpetrators saw the girls as easy meat because they were white and thought to be sexually loose. This is unquestionably appalling and discriminatory behaviour from these Asian men. Not all Muslims follow this backward way of thinking, though. So she finishes up by trying to be even-handed there and trying to say, look, I'm not just being against white people here. Look, I'm pointing out that they were attacked because they were white. And that's just an attempt of her to cover up the dishonesty that's in the rest of this. And if we really were against Muslims, would we be allowing this sort of stuff in our press that deliberately lies to us and covers up the crimes of these people by using statistics from 2011 and pretending that white people don't actually make up 85% of the population? It's disgusting that this was actually produced in a mainstream newspaper. Anyway, Max, what are your final thoughts on this article here?
Well, I concur with everything that you said. I come back to the reason why the issue of Asian grooming gangs still arouses the anger of lots of people, and where the lots of people are not prepared to forget what's taken place is the fact that the abuse took place on such a scale that the police obviously knew what was taking place, and the police obviously colluded in hiding what was taking place. And the fact that there's been no public recognition of this fact, and there has been no prosecutions of senior police officers and local government officials who knew what was taking place and who turned a blind eye to it. And until there is justice in that respect, until there are local government officials that were responsible for what happened prosecuted and brought to justice, and until there are senior police officers who knew what was going on and who participated or who condoned what was going on or turned a blind eye or whatever, until those people are prosecuted and brought to justice, then this will continue to be an issue that rankles with people, and that people will continually bring up whenever these kind of subjects are discussed.
Well, you mentioned there that the police were colluding in covering up. This journalist is colluding in covering it up. And when we see white people, white journalists, and they dare to say something sympathetic to nationalists or sympathetically against political correctness, they're absolutely ostracized by all the other white people in the press. And yet when we get a non-white journalist like this, who is colluding in trying to cover up the Muslim involvement in these grooming gangs, is absolute silence of condemnation from other Muslims from her. for doing that. And yet white people, we condemn other whites if they were to be doing something like this, but you won't hear the Muslims condemning her for making that article. It's absolutely disgusting article. As I say, I hope that it shows to people what sort of things to look for. When you see something like that, look for the date of the statistics and remember that 85% of the population actually is white. So when they say 85% of these crimes are carried out by whites, well, yes, that is actually what you would expect. Well, let's move into our Greatest Britain segment then. And this Greatest Britain that we're going to begin this week was actually brought up by you, Max, once again. Ethel Fleed, the Lady of the Mercians, who is very well respected in Mercia today. She was actually born in 870 on the 12th of June and she died in 918. And she ruled Mercia in the English Midlands from 911 until her death. She was the eldest daughter of Alfred the Great, King of the Anglo-Saxon Kingdom of Wessex, and his wife Ealhswith. And we've already talked about Alfred the Great. And I was actually surprised to see the size of Mercia. It's absolutely huge. It was Gloucestershire, Worcestershire, Herefordshire, Shropshire, all those really nice areas there on the border with Wales, stretching right the way across to the east and into Kent. It was actually larger than Wessex for a time. It was a huge part of the country, and it was a very important kingdom. But yeah, you decided that we should do Ethelfleed, the Lady of the Mercians, Max. What was your main reasoning for why you think she should be in our series of Greatest Britons?
Well, the reason is that we covered Alfred the Great a while back, and it became very apparent when we were covering Alfred the Great just what a massive contribution he made to the founding of England and to the founding of our culture, to the building up of the Christian church in Britain and to the formulation of laws. And so he obviously was a very prominent figure in English and British history. Through the research that we did when we were talking about Alfred, Ethelfleed became known to me. And I realized then that whilst Alfred the Great had this dream of creating a united England, and whilst he made great steps towards achieving that and made Wessex secure and helped to make Mercia secure, that he died long before his dream was actually realised. But he had two children. There was Ethelfleed and her brother, who was
Edward.
Edward. That's right. Yes, who then became Edward the Elder. And between the two of them, they then took his dream of a united England further forward. And so what we had was a situation in which Ethelfleed was married to Ethelred, who was the king of Mercia. And Ethelred, during Alfred's lifetime, did accept Alfred's overlordship over him. And so therefore, although Ethelred was the king of the Mercians, and although Ethelfleed was the queen of the Mercians, Alfred the Great was regarded as being their lord effectively, and so they swore fealty to him in most respects. And so after his death, Edward, who was Alfred's son, took over the monarchy of Wessex, and to some extent he had influence with Ethelfleed and with Ethelred. Quite how much influence he had is not clearly understood, and it's often assumed that he would have continued to have exercise the same kind of overlordship over Mercia that Alfred the Great did, but I don't think that's at all clear. I think really what we had after Alfred the Great died was kind of like a partnership between Edward and Ethelfleed, and so Ethelfleed continued to be the Queen of Mercia. And then when Ethelred died, she was then the sole ruler of Mercia, and continued the cooperation with Edward towards achieving her father's dream of establishing an England. And and together they built more burhs, which are the fortifications that enabled the towns and the settlements that were emerging during that period to resist attack by ravaging bands of Vikings. And they took part in a number of military campaigns and in order to extend the influence of their two kingdoms. And then when Æthelflæd died, Æthelstan, who is the son of Edward, who succeeded Edward, then became the king of both Wessex and Mercia, and also parts of Wales that Æthelflæd had drawn into alliance with Mercia as well. And so a very considerable step forward had been taken to create England as we know it today. And it was then, I think, during the reign of Æthelstan that the northern parts of England were eventually brought under his dominion as well. And he realized the dream of Alfred the Great.
So she was absolutely instrumental in fulfilling that dream and getting England all together, basically. And there is also, I mean, there's a bit of confusion of whether it was Edward or whether it was Æthelflæd, and Æthelflæd's part is sort of it's not really covered so much in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, but we hear more about her elsewhere. And this is a question: is like, how do we know that she was that important? Because she barely appears in the Saxon Chronicle. Well, details of her actions were preserved in a pro-Mercian version of the chronicle known as the Mercian Register, or the Annals of Æthelflæd, so it's actually named after her. And although that is now lost, elements from it were incorporated into several surviving versions of the chronicle. The register covers the years 902 to 924 and focuses on Æthelflæd's actions, with Edward hardly mentioned at all, and her husband only twice, on his death and as father of their daughter. Information about Æthelflæd's career is also preserved in the Irish Chronicle, known as the Three Fragments. According to Wainwright, it contains much that is legendary rather than historical, but it also contains, especially for our period, much genuine historical information which seems to have its roots in a contemporary narrative. She was also praised by Anglo-Norman chroniclers such as William of Malmesbury and John of Worcester, and she has received more attention from historians than any other secular woman in Anglo-Saxon England. Now, it's interesting that to me that they've got all this information about her over there in Ireland, because that tells us how important she was. She wasn't just important in England, she wasn't just important in Mercia, but right the way over the water there. In Ireland, they're talking about her. So whether it was, whether it's got lots of legendary stuff in there or not, the point is that she was obviously a very important person at this time. Well, she was, as I say, she was born around 870 at the height of the Viking invasions of England. And by 878, most of England was under Danish Viking rule, as we talked about in the series on King Alfred. East Anglia and Northumbria having been conquered by them, and Mercia was partitioned between the English and the Vikings. But in that year, Alfred won his crucial victory at the Battle of Edington. So maybe she was born, I don't know, maybe 9 months after the Battle of Edington. King Alfred might have been celebrating there with his wife. Soon afterwards, the English-controlled western half of Mercia came under the rule of Ethelred, Lord of the Mercians, who accepted Alfred's overlordship, and Alfred adopted the title of King of the English, claiming to rule all the English people not living in areas under Viking control. And in the mid-880s, Alfred sealed the strategic alliance between the surviving English kingdoms by marrying Æthelflæd to Ethelred. And then we see what is the sort of role mainly that these princesses actually had. They would be used to cement alliances with other nations or with other parts of the country. And because the daughter of that king had been married to this other prince or this other lord, then they would have like a union then. And it was supposed to prevent war, basically. And that was normally the role that a princess played. They would also sometimes be sent off to nunneries. They would swear to celibacy. In actual fact, one of the things that's said about Æthelflæd is that once she had had her son, she swore herself to celibacy after that. Most of the time they would be actually given away as princesses, and that was it. We wouldn't actually hear anything more about them. So the very fact that we've learned so much more about Æthelflæd tells us that, you know, she was this very important person. She was the exception to the rule, basically. I mean, she must have been to have all the, to be written about in Ireland and to be written about, elsewhere. Do you want to add anything to that?
Just say that she ranks alongside the likes of Boadicea, Elizabeth I, and Victoria as women who are critical for the development and the expansion of England and then Britain, and for the development of our culture and as great historic characters.
And also, I think it serves to show that this nonsense we're taught today, that women were just kept indoors, they weren't allowed to be educated, they were just treated as baby machines, that's not the truth. Most women wanted to be cared for, most women wanted to be protected, they wanted to be provided for, they wanted to have as many children as possible. But there were always these other women that were the exceptions to the rule, that wanted to do other things, and we never stopped them from doing that. I mean, this woman made it, she was right up there at the top there. She was written about more than her husband, who was actually the king. And as we say, this is like 1200 years ago. So it's an absolute nonsense to be told that women used to be oppressed by men. They certainly weren't. Well, one of the important things she did was rescue the relics of King Ozzy, or Saint Ozzy, from the Danelaw. Her brother Edward the Elder succeeded as Alfred, as king of the Anglo-Saxons in 899, and in 909 he teamed up with her to raid the northern Danelaw, and they returned with the remains of the royal Northumbrian Saint Oswald, which were translated to the new Gloucester Minster. The relics gave the church great prestige, as Oswald had been one of the most important founding saints of Anglo-Saxon Christianity, as well as a ruling monarch. And the decision to translate his relics to Gloucester shows the importance of the town to Æthelred and Æthelflæd, who were both buried in St. Oswald's Minster. And she actually rescued more relics than just St. Oswald's. There are quite a few relics that she managed to take back from the Danes. Now, I don't know if when the Danes moved into an area, the relics were already there in a church, or whether the Danes had actually kidnapped these relics, because they were obviously very important to the Saxons at the time, that they had these remains of their saints, because the miracles would happen around these things, and they would believe that if they didn't have their relics with them, they were going to suffer bad luck, because, you know, something that was to do with Christianity had been taken by these pagans, so they would get bad luck until they actually got them back. So it's interesting that she was a very pious lady as well. I mean, to go on this raiding party and it was purely to get back these saints' relics. It wasn't about getting more land for themselves or anything like that. So it shows that she wasn't just like a warrior queen, but she was also pious. She was also Christian. Do you know much about the relics and this raid into the Danelaw, Max?
No, I don't know much about the relics. I think basically what it shows, though, is that, use the term a sort of warrior queen. And I think that it's fairly evident from what took place that she was that kind of a character. She wasn't the sort of queen that would sit back in safety in her sort of capital city or whatever, in her castle, whilst others fought and died on the battlefield. She was somebody who was seen as a central motivating force and the type of monarch who led her armies into battle.
And she must have also been brought up with the liberal arts. She must have been educated by her father. I mean, we heard about the revival that he brought about in education and learning. And there was a similar revival happened in Mercia under Æthelflæd. Mercian scholarship had high prestige at the courts of Alfred and Edward. Worcester was able to preserve considerable intellectual and liturgical continuity, and with Gloucester became the centre of a Mercian revival under Æthelred and Æthelflæd that extended into the more unstable areas of Staffordshire and Cheshire. Charters show the Mercian leaders supporting the revival by their generosity to monastic communities. In 883, Æthelred granted privileges to Berkeley Abbey, and in the 890s, he and Æthelflæd issued a charter in favour of the Church of Worcester. In 901, Æthelflæd and Æthelred gave land and a golden chalice weighing 30 mancuses to the shrine of St. Midburg at Much Wenlock Church. So it shows that they understood that the spirituality of their people was just important as everything else. I mean, to be giving all these things to the church, it just shows you how pious they were. And the church was involved in the teaching and the learning as well. I mean, that was how people learned to read. And also, I mean, at the time, you've got these problems with the Vikings. And as we heard with Alfred the Great, it got so bad that, you know, they couldn't even read Latin in the Saxon areas. And in Mercia, they managed to have a liturgical continuity, which means that the church had managed to continue throughout all of this. They'd managed to protect it, and it was obviously important to them. Do you know much about these support of the church here? Max, did that figure in your research?
No, that's not something that I've looked into. No.
Well, then, I do find the church history interesting. Well, then Æthelflæd becomes de facto ruler. Æthelred's health probably declined at some stage in the decade after Alfred died in 899, and Æthelflæd may have become the de facto ruler of Mercia by 902, although her husband didn't actually die until 911. The accession of a female ruler in Mercia is described by the historian Ian Walker as one of the most unique events in early medieval history. I think there was actually a tradition with the Saxons that they wouldn't ever allow a woman to rule. They wouldn't ever allow a queen to rule because they had this bad queen who, I'm trying to remember the actual story. I think she went to Rome and she was asked by the king there, or one of the kings there, do you want to marry me or do you want to marry my son? And she said, oh, I'd much rather marry the son. I mean, you know, she'd much rather have the younger guy rather than the actual king. And because she had said that, she was reduced to penury and reduced to rags. And she'd actually been like a very bad person as well. I can't remember if she'd killed her husband or something like that. So the Saxons said, well, we're never going to have a queen. We will never have a queen on the throne. And that's a tradition that's written about that the early Britons thought was interesting or strange, bizarre, because of course we'd had Boadicea, we'd had famous queens before in the past, but the Saxons refused to have that. So that's why this is such a unique event in medieval history. And they didn't actually make a queen, but she ruled as if she was queen. She became the de facto ruler in 902. She was never actually made into the de jure ruler. They never actually crowned her as queen or anything like that, but she had the same powers as the king. Do you recall that myth at all, Max? I think it's in the life of Alfred the Great.
I'm not familiar with any other female rulers of any parts of Britain apart from Boadicea prior to Æthelflæd. And so my belief at the moment, I might be wrong, but my belief at the moment is that Æthelflæd was the first queen of any part of England. And so in that respect, you know, together with Boadicea, she ranks as two almost unique characters. And it wasn't really until Elizabeth I that there was a queen who ruled all of England effectively. And so you know, that's why I felt that Æthelflæd, you know, ranks with these other great historic characters, and why her life is so unusual, because as a woman, you know, you're quite right that in those sort of medieval times, even if a man had a right to the throne. If the man was was sickly or feeble, then they would be overlooked, and they would be replaced by somebody else who was younger and fitter. And so the very fact that Æthelflæd succeeded her husband and went on to lead military campaigns in conjunction with her brother illustrates that she must have been quite a formidable character from the, in the physical sense. She must have been a swordswoman, and she must have been a warrior in her own right for her to have been accepted as the queen at those times, or in that time.
Boadicea was Welsh. She was Brittonic. I think it was in the second century. Boadicea, so it was before the Saxons that had actually come over. So so actually like a different people. And then you got the Saxons who refused to have a queen, and then they had Æthelflæd. And I didn't know that it was it Elizabeth I that you said that was the first one to actually rule England? Yeah, so there you got the continuity there. And you do get these exceptions to the rule. And we've always supported them, whether we were the Britons back in the second century, whether we were the Saxons here in the ninth century, or whether we were the United Kingdom under Elizabeth I. It's, we never oppressed women. That's a nonsense. Anyway, I think we'll leave it there, Max, and get into some of her battles with the Danes, because they really are quite spectacular, the achievements that she actually made. Well, I think we'll get into them next week and finish with that here. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I do feel guilty asking people for donations when I know that a lot of you out there have lost your jobs, but if you can possibly afford to donate, then do remember to purchase some Bitcoin and send it our way. We do have overheads for the website. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you, and of course we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.